Get 3 months of The Spectator for just £15, plus a free bottle of Paul Roger champagne if you go to spectator.co.uk/jingle. This offer is UK only and time limited. It's been a historic year in British politics. The ousting of the Conservative Party after 14 years in government, the rise of the Reform Party now with 5 MPs, and Labour's landslide victory, which has turned sour very quickly indeed. On this episode of Coffee House Shots, we'll be taking a look at the major events of 2024. I'm Cindy Yu, and I'm joined by Katie Balls, Michael Gove, and a sketch writer and Spectator contributor, Quentin Letts. So, the biggest political news of the year, Katie, of course, has been the ousting of the Conservative Party after 14 years in power. Can you remind listeners of the political situation leading up to the calling of the election, and was there any world in which the Tories could have won?
It'll be interesting for the views of others on the panel too on this, who have had a different perspective. But I think it was quite clear going into 2024 that the Tories would have had a near impossible task in terms of winning the election and turning things around. Lots of people say, oh, if only Rishi Sunak had held on to the autumn, things could have looked a lot better. Look how Labour started to implode, though you could argue that was the pressure of government. That was the main trigger there. But, you know, would there have been a rates cut? Would that have helped? But I do think we were entering the world by which it was a question of what is the scale of defeat, rather than is there going to be a shock victory for the Tories. It really, I think, started to go wrong for Rishi Sunak in 2023. Mm. And, for example, I recently interviewed Rishi Sunak's chief of staff, Liam Booth-Smith, on election dates, and he said the mistake was not that they went for the summer instead of the autumn of 2024. The mistake was that they should have gone much earlier, you know, a year in the spring. And he thought, yes, everyone would have hated it, but with hindsight, that might have been the best time to go. Now, others will disagree. But I think there was just a sense of the Tories having been in power that long. It wasn't just about, was Rishi Sunak charismatic enough? Or did he have enough of a vision? A party that was increasingly fractious. You had, various anonymous plotters throwing stones from both outside and inside the tent. And then you had the question of cost of living and high inflation, which I think when you look across the world, all incumbent governments were struggling. Now, I think the Tories did some things to make it even worse for them, but it was always going to be a hard task to have anything close to a win. And I think the question on that 2024 strategy was, when they called the July election, it was a bit of a Dunkirk strategy, you know, survival is winning. And I think within that, yeah, victory is survival, you had a situation where they hoped they would keep 200 seats to 200 MPs. And in what some on the campaign later described as a cursed campaign, they obviously fell short of their target.
Well, it didn't help. It didn't help that they went at a time when Nigel Farage could easily come back into the fray. If they'd gone later, then Farage would have been tied up in America, probably. And it was the re-entry of Farage that split the right-wing vote that really was the big killer for them. And also, it would have helped had Rishi had a bit more personality. There was a total charisma vacuum. He was a terrible campaigner. And going out, it was like seeing Theresa May all over again, but Theresa May in trousers. Actually, she sometimes wore trousers, more convincingly than Rishi, perhaps. But it was a disastrous campaign, gutless campaign, humourless campaign, and they were terrified of the voters. When you're going to lose, you might as well go and meet the voters, reacquaint yourself with them. But the distance between the politicians and the public was terrible.
I think it was a campaign where a lot went wrong, and hence that target of around 200 MPs, they got 121. And I also completely agree. Strangely, their arguments by going early, Farage wouldn't return, but I agree, Quentin. I would have thought by that point he was tied up in TV contracts for the US presidential if they'd gone for the autumn.
Yeah, I think even if Rishi had been a sort of combination of Benedict Cumberbatch and Hulk Hogan, he still wouldn't have won. I'm afraid defeat was baked in beforehand. You're right, both of you, that everything that could go wrong in the campaign did go wrong. From the Prime Minister's aide having taken a bit of a flutter on the election date on the basis of, so we are given to understand, inside information, to the timing over D-Day, to, as you say, Nigel Farage's re-entry into British politics, emerging like the the alien in the movie of the same name to devour the host. So all of those things going wrong didn't help. But I think that the fate for Rishi was probably sealed even before he became prime minister. I think that the manner of Boris's going and the nature of Liz's mini budget meant that it was always going to be difficult.
Michael, now that you've come over to the light side, the good side, that is from politics into journalism.
I have left the Sith and joined the Jedi.
Yes. Tell us about what was it like behind the scenes in those months, because there has been also been reported that you, in the early election, when you were told about it, you said to Rishi Sunak, "Who dares wins?"
On the day, I certainly did. On the day concerned, there was a gathering sense of, for some expectation, for others trepidation, because a variety of meetings have been cancelled. I attended a meeting of a cabinet committee on a subject I've completely forgotten about, about 2 hours before cabinet itself was due to meet. I was due to present at cabinet on levelling up. I realised in that meeting, as people were looking nervously at their phones and watches and so on, that I would not be presenting on Levelling Up or anything
else.
Then a small group of us were summoned in just before cabinet so that Rishi explained what was going on. And at that point, you know, when you hear the whistle, when the officer, you know, takes his revolver out and says, "Right, boys, we're going over the top," my view was that that is not the moment to say, "Captain Blackadder, are you sure this is a good idea?" That is the moment when you say, "Up and at 'em!" So quite a lot of us did get machine guns shortly thereafter.
You ran the other direction. You didn't even stand again.
Well, I had a call.
Legging it back towards the general's castle.
I had a call to go back to the chateau, yes, in order to help direct other operations.
And Michael, I'm not sure if he was in the stage, but there was also an awkward moment, of ministers say, after, of course, Rishi Sunak says, "I've decided to call an election." And it's not really a debate, even though you had a couple of figures start to speak out. And there was a pre-meeting and then there was a larger meeting. And then I think it was suggested that they could all stay in the cabinet room and watch Rishi Sunak announce to the nation, calling the election, which then made for slightly awkward watching when, of course, we moved to one of the probably most memorable moments of the year, which was the rain and the lack of umbrella.
What was the discussion around the umbrella, Michael?
Well, I don't know, but we were all told that we had to stay in the cabinet room. And I asked if I could pop to the loo. And it's odd for a grown man in his 50s as a member of the cabinet to have to ask permission, but nevertheless. In fact, I didn't just go to the loo. I went into the Downing Street garden because I was so nervous I wanted to have a cigarette. I then returned to discover that the door to the cabinet had been locked and that I was in the antechamber watching the television feed with Mrs. Sunak, the bodyguards and various others. And so because there's a time delay between the broadcast and reality, Rishi's face was still on the TV screen as he came in after having given that speech. And he was looking straight ahead with a look of, I hope, resolution, but certainly I think he was also probably thinking, where's the brolly? Who took it away? Did we have to do it at that time? Mm. But to be fair to Rishi, throughout all of the election campaign, I never saw him pettish, difficult, or recriminatory with anyone. He might well have kicked the cat on a few occasions. I do know that in his preparation for the debates, he was very focused and disciplined. And the one thing that I would say, well, I'd say a number of things, is that he won those debates. Little good it did him and the broader Conservative Party, but in those critical moments when it was him versus Starmer, I think he left Starmer looking comprehensively flat-footed.
I think that's fair. But his personal mood during the election, I felt, I got quite close to him once or twice at events, and it was almost as though the shutters had come down and he wasn't acknowledging people around him. And I, you know, I would sort of shout something or make a suggestion. Why don't you go and stand over there, Prime Minister, and can we get you to jump into that tank, for instance, like that? And he just was blanking people. Well, he'd sort of retreated within himself.
There are some politicians, your Bill Clintons and so on, who can do everything all at once, who can focus on the speech ahead and glad hand. Most of the rest of us, if we've been politicians, know that just before these sort of big events, you've got to try and get in the zone. I remember that before Boris or before Theresa May would give speeches, they would sometimes just need that little bit of space to themselves to focus. The one person who could flip instantly from a cup of tea or a pint of beer beforehand to being immediately on the campaign trail was David Cameron, but there are very few people who are given that sort of ease and flexibility.
It is an important skill. in a campaign.
Ideally, you want
to be able to glad hand people and then stand up.
It completely. But and people may say that this is damning with faint praise. I don't think that the Keir Starmer is someone who enjoys the merry bonhomie of the campaign trail in the same way as Gordon Brown didn't. You can still be good in other aspects of politics, but yes, Rishi is someone who's very focused, very disciplined. He can be great fun, relaxed, and in private company, but no, he's not a campaigner a la Farage or Clinton, no.
Katie, let's talk about Starmer, because it hasn't really been plain sailing for the Labour Party since it came into government. Our Spectator Data Hub says that his approval rating is at a minus 34 at the moment, and that's quite a big drop in quite a short amount of time. What's happened?
So we probably need to give him some credit for 2024, in the sense that he did lead his party back into government after 14 years. Are we giving him credit?
I think, yeah, you'd have to say he's lucky general, but I mean, yeah, sure.
Yeah, and I think he was obviously helped by a range of factors. You know, often people say, well, oppositions don't win elections, governments lose them. And I think you can see a lot of that in Keir Starmer's path to power. When it comes to even, you know, collapse of the SNP at one point, paving the way for the Scottish Labour recovery, the high inflation going through on that, and then also just the Tories not being able to resist infighting. I think all those things helped, and it meant that Keir Starmer just standing there started to look, oh, he must be better than that other option. But there were already warning signs. I mean, for example, you spent a lot of 2024, at least the first 6 months, where if you dared to write about Morgan McSweeney versus Sue Gray, you would get a ticking off quite quickly. It was one of those stories that there are always certain stories in politics that annoy the operation more than others. Mm. And it was something, oh no, they get on very well. And then, of course, it didn't take very long.
So well that she got promoted into envoy for the regions.
Yeah,
a role envoy for the nether regions.
Yeah, no, to take up. Within just a couple of weeks, really, you started to get a sense that all was not well. So stories leaking, which were damaging to Sue Gray about money being put on her pet projects. Before you knew it, briefings about the boys again. That's another way to get a phone call if you want to talk about the Labour boys, the boys club. But a general sense of dysfunction. And really, Sue Gray initially versus Morgan McSweeney, and then it was almost Sue Gray versus the entire Labour Party. And it was very hard to find that she had any defenders. And I think that goes down to, there was a decision during the Labour campaign to have Morgan McSweeney in charge of the campaign and Sue Gray in charge of the preparations for government. And that meant sense to a degree, because you're not overlapping on those things. It means you have a clear focus, but obviously there's a tension between the two. And all of a sudden they win, but the plan for government is, in the words of some Labour aides, almost non-existent. And also you have various power plays and a disjointed approach, where there is lots of stories about where is Morgan McSweeney's desk in relation to Keir Starmer's, which may sound pretty primary or high school, but it's always a good sense of where things might sit.
But the killer moment, surely, was when she asked to be paid more than the Prime Minister. And that...
Did she ask, or was that just like a civil service band thing?
Oh, is that how it works?
I don't know.
I think normally you ask for a pay rise. But the significance of that was it. In the civil service, how much you are paid signifies your seniority. And if you're being paid more than the Prime Minister, it suggests perhaps you think you are senior to the Prime Minister, which, given the clunker that he is excusable, but it's probably not very politic.
And I think for the BBC to get that story, which was clearly a damaging, it just, again, made it much harder for them to go back to there's nothing to see here. The BBC political editor publishing that story and having quotes suggesting, it was suggested to Sue Gray that this might not be the wisest thing to earn more than the Prime Minister.
Yes.
Really, I think then it was a question of, well, she's not at Labour Party conference. That's interesting. She was there the year before. And
how
then, of
could
course,
she resist
left.
It?
Like, who couldn't? The Spectator now has a drinks there, so.
Away from the management then, in terms of policies, Michael, it's not always been plain sailing there either. You know, they started with the war against pensioners. Then they waged a war against farmers. Mm-hmm. And of course, in between that, the budget has had, raised taxes on many different levels. Are these unforced errors, or are these exactly what they wanted to do coming in?
No, they are definitely not what they wanted to do coming in. I think there were two things that they did want to do coming in. One was to try to paint the sky dark before they had their budget. They wanted to say, look at this terrible mess that we've inherited. But they got into a war of interpretation over the figures. And then, because they had cut the winter fuel allowance for pensioners, that became the story. Mm. And at the same time as they'd done that, they had also authorised an increase for workers in the public sector, particularly train drivers, who are relatively well off in comparison to other public sector workers. And so it made it seem like it was a straight robbing granny to pay ASLEF. And that was toxic. Now, subsequent to that, there have been efforts to tell a broader story about the economy, but it's been a difficult one for Rachel Reeves because the overall gospel of gloom, because we've inherited this terrible picture from the Tories, has actually meant that the most recent figures, which show growth actually, you know, below 0%, suggest that the gloom has been overdone, that a signal has been sent that Britain is a shabby, rundown and decrepit place that you wouldn't want to invest in. And it's against that backdrop that in the last few weeks we've seen the Labour government trying to get a bit more pep and ziz, talking about the investment it's secured, talking about planning reform and so on. So I do detect a little bit of renewed petrol in the engine, but certainly the first 6 months of Labour, first 5 months of Labour, were a series of political misfirings or drives into cul-de-sacs or prangs.
Well, one of the best prangs was Lord Alley.
Yes.
And that was coming at the same time as the pensioners having their winter fuel allowance taken away. There was Lord Alley dishing out very smart outfits to Angela Rayner.
Yeah.
Has she worn them yet?
I think when you have a situation where you see Keir Starmer and you want to say, who are you wearing? By which you mean which donor rather than designer, you know you've got to quite a tricky yes. place.
Do you see that as a naivety from not having been in government for a long time, not knowing where, not necessarily where the technical lines are, but where the optical lines should be in terms of taking these
figures? I see it as greed. Okay. They just completely had their hands in it. And also, but the other thing we've been learned, I mean, this is not very sort of policy matter. You lot do policy. I do the character. I look at the character of the politicians. And we've learned that the Prime Minister is a petulant man. Mm. He doesn't like facing criticism. And he pushes out his mouth in a slightly mooish way, M-O-U-E. Mm. And he becomes very baity about being got at. There's no ability to laugh at himself.
Well, he has a great belief and confidence in his own integrity. And he believes...
Misplaced.
And he believes that he's followed the rules. And as a lawyer, that is what you must do at all times. So you or I might say, you might have been following the rules by the letter, but the spirit of the rules was intended to prevent X or Y. But he would say, well, show me which of the rules I haven't followed. And if you say, oh, come off it, this is politics. It's not the law. He again looks offended because, you know, his own sense of his personal integrity matters hugely to him.
But as his acting is not very good. When confronted by an alternative view, he pulls back his neck and does a sort of startled bog brush thing, and it makes him look resentful of being questioned, which is not very good for a prime minister. As a prime minister, you should be open to ideas and also to the main idea that you may have things wrong. So, you know, it's no bad thing occasionally. It's not sort of U-turning, it's finessing and it's being reasonable. And that's what's lacking in his character projection.
Yes, I think that's right. I think that there was a lightness of touch to Tony Blair, a capacity, I mean, he didn't welcome criticism most of the time, but there was a capacity to roll with it, absorb it and then hit back.
Yeah, behind the scenes, I think Blair was jolly cross about being criticised, but he was able in public to project a more reasonable view. And Starmer can't do that.
Katie, receiver's them is that approval ratings, once they start going down, they don't really tend to come back up unless there's a pandemic or some kind of external event. War, exactly. Short of another pandemic or another war, do you think Keir Starmer has much opportunity to turn things around next year?
Well, he's got time on his side. Now, of course, time could just see his government be worn down further. He could struggle. We've already had the first reset, which I think is pretty unthinkable if you thought about the scale of victory, how things look for Blair this early on, that they felt the need to give the speech on the milestones. And I think next year we'll be saying it will feel a little bit Rishi Sunak-esque in the sense of the five priorities, the six milestones, figures will come through and say, well, that's not very good for that one, and like ticking his homework and so forth. But time brings events. It's not necessarily war, it's not necessarily a pandemic. It could be misfortune for the other parties. His approval ratings don't have to go up particularly. It could be that everyone else has just sink even further. And that is perhaps the more, not saying it will necessarily happen, but there's also, you know, another option for Keir Starmer. And then, of course, if you have the Reform and the Tory party, and Reform is currently a problem for Labour too, but it could just be that Reform and Tories are more of a problem for one another.
As long as the right, as long as the right is divided, exactly. then Starmer doesn't really have to worry, or the Labour Party. I mean, Starmer might go, and you know, he might just find he doesn't like it very much, and Wes Streeting might like it more.
Totally, and you could be fantastically unpopular and still find a way through in that scenario. So I think next year will be. I think there's a big Farage question next year, which is who is he the biggest problem for, and how do both Keir Starmer and Cammy Badenoch respond to him? Because I think if you have the local elections in May, where Reform have a really strong showing, outperforming both of the main parties, you'll start to have, I think, both figures in the Tory and Labour Party panicking about the idea there could really potentially be a chance as a Prime Minister Farage, and that could lead to figures on both sides doing some quite... panicky things, maybe.
Well, let's talk about Reform, because they do seem to be the big winners of this year. You know, when you say that other ratings are going down, Reform star seems to be rising. Michael, is there any limit to how far they could rise? Could there be a Prime Minister Farage?
I'd bet against it, but I'm obviously I don't take my betting advice from the Prime Minister's former PPS, so I can't say that it's a certainty. But I think there's a natural ceiling to his support in the way that there isn't for other parties. But, you know, there are three things that help him. He's a brilliant communicator. Trump's victory and his proximity to Trump creates a halo effect around him. And linked to those, there's a sort of curiosity about it. People in our collective trade now, in journalism, are looking for the new thing. And, of course, it may seem odd to say that about a politician who is now 60, but he is the newcomer in Parliament, as we acknowledged at our Parliamentarian of the Year awards. And Reform is a new phenomenon. We've never had a party to the right of the Conservatives with representation like this in the House of Commons from a general election. So that means that the challenge for, as Katie was saying, for both Cammy Badenoch and Keir Starmer is proportionately greater because they have records to defend, even as Cammy is pointing out, what went wrong under the Conservatives, whereas he has, as the Liberal Democrats had until 2010, the total freedom of manoeuvre that comes from being able to pick your issues without worrying about your record.
Quentin, it feels like we've not really heard much from Cammy Badenoch so far. Will we hear more, hopefully, from her next year?
Well, she's got to do some thinking, hasn't she? But she hasn't got much time, and she does need to demonstrate some character. She needs to tell us who she is rather than what her policies are. And I think maybe there's a slight feeling I've got that perhaps she's a little bit lazy and a bit sort of snooty. And she needs to be more demotic and to cut through and to sort of grab hold of the red wall voter and say, look, this is me and I really do matter to you. She's a bit aloof at the moment. I'm more sceptical about Reform's long-term prospects. And it reminds me slightly of the SDP came in and everyone swore that they're going to vote for the SDP, and then it never quite happened. But the SDP had more policy depth than Reform. There's very little there, very little in the way of policy thinking, and it does matter.
Yeah, yes, and their policies on, for example, the NHS, where they want to dismantle the current health system and replace it with a sort of insurance system, almost sort of precisely calculated to discombobulate, to put it mildly, voters in the red wall. And I know what you mean when you refer to Cammy in the way that you did, Quent, but I do know that she is a hard worker and a focused worker from alongside
I'm sure she is. I completely accept that behind the scenes she's been... Yeah. But just look at the way that the public looks at it.
No,
they,
sure.
They sort of think, well, you know, she hasn't really sort of... She hasn't gone off yet. She hasn't exploded yet. Let's see some fireworks. Mm-hmm. The fuse needs to be lit.
I think one of the things about us as journalists, again, is that there is a natural appetite for excitement. And I think the one of the things that Cammy identified during a leadership campaign is if you take policy positions too early, then circumstances can change and you can end up looking foolish for having done so. I appreciate, though, that the point that Quent was making was he's not asking, others are not asking for knowing what the basic rate of tax will be in 5 years' time. It's just fleshing out a broader story about the sort of country that you want and values you have.
Yeah, and I think if you look at Labour's pledge on the £28 billion of green spending, for example, that was, we need to say something at Labour conference to grab the agenda from the Tories, and then they had to drop it and scale it back because the circumstances changed as the election neared, and they began to think it was something that would hurt them electorally. So she doesn't want to do that. The problem she has is the strategy of letting Labour just almost create their own problems and sit there having your policy commissions that will start in the new year works quite well if Labour are your main opponent, because she has Nigel Farage, she almost needs a two-pronged strategy of doing the thinking, which is going to get you the long-term answers, and not just doing sound bites, but also having something to slightly neuter Nigel Farage.
Yeah. Katie is right about the relentless pressure within politics for policy announcement at conference, which should be resisted. I remember when I was the Shadow Education Secretary, Ken Baker, one of my predecessors, had convinced George Osborne and David Cameron that his idea for a new type of university technical college was a great idea. I was a wee bit sceptical. Anyway, there was a commitment to have 12 of them, and then in the meeting it was decided actually we should have 13, so we could have the headline Baker's Dozen for technical colleges.
Great to know. Works. Yes, exactly. Great to know what happens behind the scenes. And finally, everyone, can I please have your most memorable moment of the year, Quentin?
Craig McKinley coming into the Commons after he'd had his multiple amputations, sepsis victim, Tory MP, who had not always been the most sympathetic figure. And then he walked back into the Commons that day, the day actually of the general election being called, PMQs, just before PMQs, and he stood there in the middle of the floor of the House of Commons and just raised his new false arms and looked up, and it was a most unforgettable, brilliant, uplifting moment.
Katie?
So I think mine was one that didn't actually happen in real time. So we stayed up live blogging the general election, and of course you had the rain, you had Liz Truss losing her seat, you had lots of shocks that perhaps weren't huge shocks when you really thought about them. But normally they'd go to every count when you thought there was going to be a potential Michael Patillo moment or, you know, a big win. And they did not go to this politician's count because no one saw it coming. And all of a sudden you just heard them say, oh, Jonathan Ashworth's lost his seat. And this was a member of the Shadow Cabinet, you know, their attack dog. He was out so much during the general election campaign, and he lost it to a pro-Gaza independent. And now you have five pro-Gaza independents in the House of Commons. And I think that was a moment that just genuinely caught the Labour Party and others by surprise and picked up on a trend that had been talked about during the general election campaign, perhaps the true scale of which was not known.
Michael.
Second reading of the assisted dying bill, one of the most significant pieces of legislation that we've seen so far. I, as it happens, I'm opposed to the legislation, and when the scale of the victory, the sort of 50 plus votes came through, I was struck. Actually, I felt quite emotional about it in a way that I wouldn't have thought that I did anymore, because I'm no longer involved
by the
in politics.
I
thought it would be close, and so I was not surprised, not amazed, but disappointed by the scale of that. Because again, I sort of knew that when you've got a majority broadly of that kind, notwithstanding the fact that there were a number of people who said that they voted for it, but might, if the legislation wasn't improved, not support it. Others will rejoice, but I fear that that is going to become legislation, and that will change our society in a significant way.
I think the House of Lords are going to crawl all over it, aren't they?
I think they will, but I think that when you've got a Commons majority of that size, and when you've now got the government sort of clicking into gear behind it, but, you know, their lordships are very, very good at applying a, what's the word?
Their lordships are also very, very old.
Yes.
And I think, oh, this is getting a bit close to us.
Yes.
Michael, Katie, and Quentin, thank you very much.